This is Yale's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We wonder from time to time why it is that white people tend to live with white people and Asian people tend to live with Asian people and people of color, et cetera, et cetera. You know the drill. A lot of people have studied this, and the latest is Professor Jessica Trounstein of the University of California at Merced. You came up with a report called The Geography of Inequality, and I'm just going to cut to the chase. After reading through your report, it seems to me that what you're saying is that single-family zoning has become code for whites only. Is that true?
That's a little bit of an overstatement. So, you know, the paper actually draws on some additional work that I have that goes back and looks at the history of zoning and the development of land use regulation at the beginning of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So my analysis in the book starts in 1890. And what I find is that very early on, race becomes a way in which people think about their property values. So the race of their neighbors affects property values. And starting from the earliest land use implementation, cities tried to create places where white homeowners could have exclusive enclaves. And it changes over time how that's created. Today, it's largely created through single family home zoning, low density zoning, open space zoning, protecting certain areas. So there's a variety of different mechanisms that cities can use. And probably your listeners and you are familiar with strategies like placing highways in certain locations and not in other locations. These kinds of land use decisions are all part of the same process by which cities are able to protect white communities.
Well, you looked at Seattle in particular, and what did you find?
So I don't have a great deal of detail on Seattle, but I do have some. And what I find is that Seattle follows the same exact trajectory as I've been mentioning. So what happens, and let me give you a little bit more of a background here. Cities in the early part of the 20th century mostly used land use regulation to create zoning, to create segregation within their city boundaries, right? So people, so cities create neighborhoods, white exclusive neighborhoods, and that generates segregation across neighborhoods. And Seattle fits this pattern very well. My data indicate that Seattle's segregation peaked around 1950 and then started to decline within the city, as it has throughout the United States. But it didn't decline in Seattle as dramatically as it declined in a lot of places. And so I went looking for a little bit more evidence about this, more detail about this, and I've learned that Seattle's land use regulatory index, sort of the way in which Seattle manages land use, is very restrictive, and it's incredibly restrictive when you compare it to other large cities and other cities that are the center of their metropolitan areas. I was actually surprised at how high their land use regulatory index was.
And that is a big issue now because of homelessness. We have a tremendous amount of close-in neighborhoods which are still zoned for single-family houses in cities where those would long ago have been converted into apartment buildings. And what's interesting your report is that what you're saying is when communities do that, well, when communities put their foot down on development, they're simply saying, we want to protect the character of the neighborhood. But what you're saying is, despite that argument, what they are really doing is keeping non-white people out.
That's right. And it's a combination of keeping low-income people out, but even more dramatically, it's keeping out people of color. And the history of this is pretty clear that this is what strict land use regulation does and has this effect.
Now, it is, of course, illegal to discriminate on the basis of color, but family wealth is a close proxy for color these days. And so it is not illegal to have communities that have similar economic levels. In fact, that seems to be preferred because it keeps property values up. So how do you change that?
Well, there's the Supreme Court has determined over and over again that land use regulation that restricts based on the value of the property, so wealth, doing things like creating minimum lot sizes and preventing apartment complexes from being built in certain areas, is constitutional. The way in which I think that we move past this is actually to take the decision away from local governments. And I don't say that lightly. I study local politics. I've studied local politics for my entire career, and I'm a big fan of local democracy. But what I have seen is that it's only when state governments get involved and attempt to increase the density in various communities that we see movement in this area.
So this has to be forced down their throats. You know, in communities like Seattle, when you are about to demolish a single family house, put an apartment building, they put a big white sign on the lot and say zoning use change. And you have, I think it's a 60 or 90 day comment period. I mean, they make sure the entire neighborhood knows what's going to go there and when you can go to the city council to complain about it.
That's a terrific example of exactly how this process works. So when cities have regulations that allow homeowners or even renters in a particular neighborhood to stall development, they do. And not my research, but some other colleagues of mine's research finds that any time you have more regulations, the ability to stall increases, and developers oftentimes will give up. They won't want to fight the neighborhood. They won't want to fight the community. It becomes very expensive legally to try to implement certain kinds of high-density development. And so developers will often walk away from this process.
So which cities are actually doing something like you suggest? Anybody?
You know, that it's a great question. My research indicates that Riverside, California, is the most diverse and integrated city in my entire data set. And huh. So perhaps we could learn more from Riverside, California. But my work tends to look at big picture trends rather than specific instances.
Because I can see where if you stop putting up the alert signs that a new house is being built in your area, and instead just, you know, the bulldozers showed up one day, knocked down the old house, the construction workers went to work, the neighbors would still raise holy hell.
They might, although there may be fewer opportunities for them to formally stop the process. I actually did pull a few pieces of information. I wanted to see how Seattle compared to, say, Portland on my land use regulatory index measure, or a city like Boston. Boston and Portland both have much lower, many fewer regulations in place. And so it's likely that a homeowner who wanted to stop development would have an easier time doing that in Seattle than they would in a place like Portland or Boston.
Seriously, I always thought that Portland was far more militant about preventing development than even Seattle was. But again, I guess that's the important conclusion of your study. I'm wondering if you have gotten any reaction, because many of the communities that are at the heart of the problem, especially here in Seattle, I think would describe themselves as liberal as it gets.
That's right. This is a very interesting component of this research, is sort of trying to understand what it means to be liberal at the local level, and what it means to be liberal with regard to land use is not the same thing as what it means to be liberal in national politics. And I've conducted some interviews, just a small number of interviews. And, you know, most people who want to stop development in their community are not, they're not acting in a way that they see themselves as being racist or bringing race into the picture. That's not what the results say at all. These are not individuals who harbor prejudice in their heart. These are structures of government that have been in existence for over 100 years that perpetuate inequality. And regardless of how a person feels about their sort of own political orientation or people of color individually, their actions have this consequence.
And have you actually gone to, say, a community meeting and confronted people with this reality?
Not to community meetings, I have not. I'm beginning to become more engaged in the policy world. I have written a couple of reports that describe the consequences for doing things like putting all of the apartment complexes in one area of town, right? That has the same effect of increasing segregation in the community, even as it diversifies the place. But to date, I haven't confronted any set of sort of angry homeowners directly.
I want to read just one part of your report here. You find that white Republicans have a strong preference for whiter communities. The whiter the community, the more it was favored by white Republican respondents. White Democrats were indifferent between communities that were between 75% and 96% white. But both were preferred to communities that were only 50% white. So even people who would call themselves Democrats also have this preference to be among their own people.
That's right. And we don't have, we still need to collect more data as a group of political scientists on exactly what that threshold is. But it's very clear that if you are, if you present respondents with a community that is 50% people of color or greater, white respondents are very unlikely to be willing to move into that community.
Professor Jessica Traunstein of the University of California, Merced, is the author of The Geography of Inequality, How Land Use Regulation Produces Segregation and Polarization. It's an eye-opener, Jessica. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.